continue their education, return to work, and the chance to live independently in the community. Members and staff work side by side to support rehabilitation and recovery. We believe passionately in each member's potential to realize his or her dreams and live a hopeful and fulfilling life. I'm Larry Carroll, Executive Director of Bridge House. You can find out more about us at bridgehousect.org or call 203-335-5339.
Thank you for listening to WPKN in Bridgeport, 89.5 FM, and online at WPKN.org, your community radio station for music, information, and a whole lot more.
My name is Martha Willette Lewis, and this is a monthly program discussing arts and culture locally, globally, maybe one day across the universe. Anyway, today we are going to be talking to artist Judy Harvest, and the theme is going to be Things That Are Vanishing. That was music from the 1998 movie The Vanishing, a Dutch film by George Sluzer. And today's guests are Judy Harvest, who is an artist who divides her time between New York City and Venice and makes work collaborating with bees and glassblowers on the island of Murano. And we will also be talking later on to Paul Klabbe from the John Slade Eli House. But first, let's start with Judy. Hi, Judy. Are you there?
Yes. Hi, Martha. How are you?
I'm fine. So you are an artist who lives and works in New York and Murano, Italy. And you have an installation coming up at this forthcoming Venice Biennale. It's called Dialogue of Fire, and it is artists from Barcelona and Venice. Is that correct?
Yes, it is.
That sounds wonderful. What interested me about you and why I wanted to talk to you today in context of Things That Are Vanishing is your collaboration with both bees and with the Murano glassblowers and your project, Denatured, which the exhibit is over now, but the garden that you created is still ongoing, and I was hoping that you could talk a little bit about that with us.
Sure, yes. Well, the project Denatured Honeybees in Murano was in 2013 for the last Venice Biennale.
Mm-hmm.
And I had noticed that there was an abandoned field. I'm working with the same factory in Murano since 1988, so 27 years, with the same family,
mm-hmm.
which at the time, when I began working there, had 75 glass workers and now has only four, the father, his two sons, and his daughter.
And that's fairly standard for over there?
With the family, yes, definitely. It is it's something that's handed down from generation to generation. Also like beekeeping, which is something they have in common.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, I saw as I would go to the factory for years and years, I noticed that they had a field, kind of an abandoned field that was attached to the factory. And at the same time, while I was noticing the diminishing workers in the glass factories around Murano and many for sale signs on the factories, was the same time Colony Collapse was getting all of the attention about the honeybees who were
mm-hmm.
disappearing, 50 million per day. So I put the two colonies of beauty that I was interested in some way put together into one exhibition. That was my goal in any case. And
it's amazing because I would have never thought of putting them together necessarily, but now that you've done it, it seems such a natural combination. And you have really good work on your website, which is judyharvest.org, is that right?
.com.
Sorry. Anyway, people can look up full information on Denatured there, and I hope you will see the garden and the objects that we're discussing. So how did you go about clearing the garden out and making getting permission and so forth?
Well, I asked the owner of the factory, who I know for a long time, if it would be okay to clean up the field, and he sort of looked at me surprised and said, "Yeah." I mean, he had enough things to worry about just keeping his factory going. He was certainly not going to plant a garden. So I went out there, and I realized that I had to sort of excavate approximately 12 to 18 inches of the existing soil. And then I purchased 6 boatloads of new soil.
Mm-hmm.
And then 500 plants, 30 flowering fruit trees, and then began to research where I could get honeybees in the area, and did all of that in a matter of 3 weeks, while at the same time, inside the factory, I was producing the objects which would be shown at my exhibition, the sculptures, which were called honey vessels.
Wow.
So I was going from the inside to the outside of the factory, at which time I realized that you go from the flames of the furnace to the green of the garden, which what I was doing at the time, and noticing that, you know, how different the feeling was. But they were both, because they were done at the same time, and because they were both a commitment time-wise, and working with nature inside the factory with the materials I was using, which came from the earth, and working outside with the actual earth, it just seemed like it was, you know, it was definitely going to happen, but it was an overwhelming, and maybe too ambitious project, I thought at the time. But
apparently not, but it is a very, very ambitious way of incorporating two things that you obviously care about really deeply. One of the interesting things, for people who don't know, Murano is an island off of Venice that houses furnaces and the glass-blowing community, and these are master artisans who have deeply kept secrets, recipes, is that correct?
Yes.
And there are very, very few green spaces on the island, so this is like a little oasis. Were there any bees on the island before you brought them?
Well, everybody told me there weren't, but it seems, yeah, people didn't notice, because bees don't, first of all, they're not so obvious, they're small and so on, and, you know, the hives aren't necessarily visible if they're, you know, in a tree or something. So, yeah, as I would walk there, I noticed that there were a few of them on clover as I would walk around from the Vaporetto to the factory.
Mm-hmm.
So I figured that it could work, and I know that there were some, I had researched that there are some on the island of Saint Erasmus, which is the island about 30 minutes by boat from Murano, which grows all of the vegetables for the island. So I gave it a shot. And I went and talked to the beekeeper, and he wasn't convinced, but we did it. And he brought over 4 beehives for me. And, you know, the thing is that bees travel 3 miles in each direction every day foraging.
Mm-hmm.
3 miles going and 3 miles back to their hive from sunup to sundown. And they cover a very large territory. But, of course, the problem in Venice is that most of the spaces they would travel to were over large bodies of water.
Right, right. And this leads me to something. This is how I became aware of your work in the first place. You have a really wonderful video that shows a bee catching a ride on a Vaporetto. A Vaporetto is like a water bus, and they go all over to the different islands around, in and around Venice. So you caught a video of a bee actually catching a ride on the Vaporetto, and I'm wondering how you think. Do you think the bees know the Vaporetto routes?
Definitely, definitely. I think they have an incredible instinct. Well, besides that, they do a dance called the waggle dance.
Oh yeah, talk to us about that.
A waggle dance is the only insect that actually dances to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Their form of communication. They don't have ears. They buzz, but the buzzing is just part of their nature. It's not a communication tool. Their tool is a dance. They have 2 dances, actually. And it was discovered in 1923 by Carl von Fritsch. And amazing, he also discovered they can, you know, understand color and come back to their house, their hives, because of the color of the houses. But beyond that, the waggle dance is done in the direction of the sun, and it's in the shape of figure 8. And the faster they dance, the closer the foraging site is, and the slower they dance, which would be the round dance, is just for the gardens and the spaces that are near their hives. So this dance is very specific and very accurate. They go in the direction of the sun, and they can tell each other by returning to the hive, where they actually have a dance floor. And they're now their little furry bodies.
I love this.
The pollen from the flowers. Mm-hmm. And so they have a scent. So, of course, the bees, you know, mm-hmm. highest, you know, sense is, of course, their sense of smell.
Right.
So they decipher the flowers by scent and by color, and they come back to the hive. They do a little dance at the entrance of the hive. They don't want to go running all over the hive to gather up their sisters and tell them where the, you know, the flowers are.
Mm-hmm.
They dance right at the entrance, and off they go. So they naturally, you know, because they're so smart, I think they definitely know, you know, the Vaporetto roots as well. You know, they'll tell them, you know,
mm-hmm.
tell them.
But this is particularly impressive because of how complicated the Vaporetto roots actually are. So where are they going? They're going to Sant'Orazmo, which is the gardens. They're going to the cemetery.
Yes, the cemetery is a very big island. In Venice, they have separate islands for everything. Murano is there with the furnaces because they didn't want Venice to catch fire and keep mm-hmm. the furnace, you know, didn't work out right. So they have an island for lace, an island for, you know, the furnaces of glass, and they have an island for a cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
The cemetery island is very close to Murano. It's the closest island, and people bring fresh flowers there, and flowers do grow there, and so it's a wonderful place for bees. They love cemeteries. Nobody bothers them, and they have lots to choose from. So, you know, I noticed it's always crowded,
mm-hmm.
the Vaporetto, so I always stand outside, and when I get off at when I'm about to get out at Murano, the stop before is the cemetery, and I noticed bees, you know, coming
mm-hmm.
on. Not a lot, two or three. And they stay on the outside by the window, obviously, because they have to hop right off. So I couldn't believe it. And so one day I just said, I have to film it. No one's going to believe it.
Right. And it sure is really enough, remarkable.
So they really do wait for the boats, yes.
And so the other thing is that on your website, you have a really lovely video that was part of Denatured called Breakfast with the Bees, and it combines images of the bees in the garden and the workers blowing these glass vessels that are very much like molten honey and getting sort of pushed through this chicken wire grating that creates these hive formations, and you've coated the outsides with things that are like pollen, and I understand... did you actually use real amber in the process? Can you talk a little bit about the process with the glass blowers? Because they're really remarkable. They truly do echo bee products.
Oh, thank you. That was a remarkable part. The more and more I got into the concept, the more similarities I found.
Mm-hmm.
Molten glass and honey have very similar properties physically, you know, in the beginning in any case, because then glass becomes, you know, a hard material. But the color amber was something I worked on a long time. Honey changes its color depending on the season and the flowers that are available to the bees. So the very first honey is the most transparent.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first honey I was able to harvest and extract, actually, in Murano, tasted like roses. And it was very clear, very transparent, because the predominant flower in Murano are roses, and some of them are very old. They're antique roses.
That sounds so exquisite.
Is amazing. They have these roses. Some of them are like the size of a human hand. You know, I mean, they're just enormous roses. But so the bees were, you know, were going crazy, I'm sure, with that. And the colors that I chose ranged from the very light, transparent first spring honey to the fall honey, which is very dark, dark amber. You know, so it's the same in the glass. And the way I got the colors was by using gold leaf
mm-hmm.
and different combinations of pigments, which are minerals that come from the earth.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of amber, there's real amber in it. And that is the beauty of Murano glass, is that they, beside the recipes and the secrets, they still use, you know, actual, you know, pigments and things from the earth, which, you know, the basic material in glass making is sand.
Mm-hmm.
And
which is coming from the bottom of the water. There's a relationship between the water and the color patterns reflecting on the water, and the fact that there's sand at the bottom of the lagoon, and the fact that Venice has such a deep history of trade, especially with the East, and collecting rare minerals and substances, presumably amber as well, that fits sort of beautifully into the whole project.
Yes, definitely. I mean, it's the idea that, you know, in Venice, there's so much of nature is used in what they do, the idea of reflection in the mirrors and the glass
mm-hmm.
and all of the you know, the other artists that have been attracted to Venice over the years have used the idea of reflection. And I think that in the case of Murano, the reason we, you know, I'm trying to, you know, bring awareness and bring attention to it is it would be a shame, really, to see it disappear. And I, you know, I don't expect that I can single-handedly save Murano, but I think artists have this ability to, you know, to bring attention in the way of beauty without, you know, realizing that they're doing it sometimes. In my case, I didn't think that this, I hoped my exhibition would be an ongoing one and people would go to the garden and visit the factory and keep the factory in business and then go back and plant lavender and, you know, grow pesticide-free gardens for the bees.
And have they been?
And they have been. The factory actually has improved. They're, I mean, economically, I think they're doing better, and certainly more people go there, which is unusual because it's in Sacra Serenella. It's not the actual first stop for Murano.
And it's Linnea Ariana Glass Factory.
Linnea Ariana.
Yes.
Linnea Ariana, and it's a dad, Giorgio Giuman, and his two sons and his daughter. And
one can go visit your garden, is that correct?
Yes. You can visit it during the hours that the factory's open, which is 9 to 4. And it's always best to call ahead of time.
Sure.
And, you know, yeah, they're happy when people visit. And you actually see a real working factory.
Which is exciting.
Which,
you
know, which is exciting. And they use these antiques, these antique techniques that no one else does, which is the lost wax process, make the morine. And it's the real thing. It's not like some man meeting you at the, a guide meeting you at your hotel and taking you to a factory, which, you know, actually doesn't necessarily make the products that they're creating.
No, and glass blowing and glass making is just totally magic to watch. It's riveting. And your film Breakfast of with the Bees gives a kind of small taste of that. The other thing I wanted to talk to you about, I'm really fascinated by the fact that bees are so color-oriented, and your beehives are wonderfully painted in bright colors that echo the houses in the island of Burano. And so you've actually painted the houses as a kind of miniaturization of that, and it's really lovely. Can you talk about bees and color? And just quickly, I want to say that I am Martha Willette Lewis, excuse me, and I am in conversation with artist Judy Harvest, and this show is Live Culture.
Thank you, Martha. Well, yes, the color, the colors are very important to bees, obviously, because of the flowers, and they are red blind. They don't see red. They go for flowers that are blue, purple, yellow, white, and they actually recognize their house, their hives, by returning at night and seeing the actual colors. And if they go by mistake to the wrong hive, they get kicked out. So, you know, they don't make a mistake. If they do, they're you know, sent over to the house next door. And it's not unlike what the island of Burano, which is the lace-making island, and it's naturally where there were a lot of fishermen in the island in those days, in the beginning, and there still are. And the houses, which are row houses, and they're painted very distinct, very bright colors. One to the next, they go from like emerald green to a shocking pink.
Yeah, they're wonderful. It's just so wonderful.
The fishermen could see their houses as they went up to sea, and so they would return at night. So as I would pass Burano on the way to Saint Erasmus to, you know, speak to the beekeeper and try to convince him to give me four of his hives, I noticed that, you know, they were similar in scale to what I was going to be using in Murano in the honey garden. And colors just seemed natural for me because the bees would have passed those going back and forth to Saint Erasmus and Murano. So I figured, you know, let's keep it in the same color palette, and hopefully they would be okay with that. Recently I had to replace the hives because the wood became a little bit old, and it was time to replace them due to the humidity in Venice and so on, and I had to go and repaint them the same colors because you don't want to confuse the bees.
You don't want to confuse the bees, right?
No, you don't.
You
so
know,
that's why they like lavender and, you know, those colors.
I think a lot of artists, well, one of the things that I admire about your project is that you have really found a way of combining all of the things that you care about into a project that is comes awfully close to something like social sculpture. So you've created this garden, but you're also spending your life working with things that you care about, like gardens and bees and glass, and that it's kind of enriching you in this collaboration, but you're also enriching it. I'm curious about what you do with the honey.
Well, first off, for me, there's no difference between art and life.
No.
So it's just blurred all together and made sense to me. I was hoping it would make sense to everyone else and that it would work out, and I'm really grateful that it has. The fact that it's ongoing, and you mentioned social sculpture, it does change by the minute, this garden, by the day. The factory workers take photographs every time a flower blooms, you know, and they
That is so lovely.
It's really beautiful. So they've gotten involved in it as well, which was my first hope. And so real-world activism for an artist is something that's a little difficult to do because it could become more political than it did artistic. And I really, you know, it was a fine line. And although I make the honey, actually the bees make the honey, I simply extract it and use a centrifuge and so on, I don't really make an effort to sell it. There's not that much of it. It goes with the sculptures. If a collector purchases the sculpture, they receive the honey, and it goes to the people in the factory, and I give it away, mainly, and I'm happy about that. You know, people have contacted me about buying it, and there's not enough of it. I don't want to stress out the bees.
And
I don't really have a full-time beekeeper in Murano. I have people that help me from time to time, so it's not an industry.
Well, no, there's something different about having it be a gift, not a commodity.
Yes, but it was used as money in the old days. Honey was money. It was traded among farmers and people to, and it doesn't ever expire, and it's got antibiotic. It's a natural antibiotic. So there's so many properties to honey that's so beautiful. And, you know, the image that you used to announce this program today was, you know, something that just shows you how far back
and
honey goes.
Right. That image is a watercolor painting after by an archaeologist after a cave painting, and it shows a woman reaching up and harvesting honey from a hive, and it just shows how really old and profound our relationship with bees and with honey are. I mean, they're probably one of the first important animal-man relationships we had going. So,
yes, and it's true, and the communication between the beekeeper and the bee is a very beautiful thing. I mean, Rudolf Steiner addressed it in his book on bees, and it's something that I have found is very spiritual, actually. You know, when you go towards the bee, you have to approach the hive without fear, and they sense that. You know, they can sense the fear and the non-fear and the kindness. And they will come and land on my hand, you know. Like, they're not, you know, pets. They're not domesticated animals.
No. But you did say they followed you around.
They follow me around. They definitely follow me around. No matter where I go, there's a bee. And it's like a little guardian angel in a way. It's a strange thing. But I think that the beehive does kind of a soul going on, as does the factory. I don't think that the factory workers in glass, even though they're making horses or they're making clowns or they're making whatever they're making, when they work there, beside their skill and their, you know, their history, which goes into every piece, there is actually an artistic soul in there. And when they work with artists and you collaborate with them, they really get to express it even further. I've been really, really lucky.
You have been really lucky, but they've been really lucky to have you. Judy, I want to thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you, Martha.
And I'm really looking forward to seeing what you come up with for your next exhibit in the Biennale. And thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Honeybee shut out from the colony, and they won't let me in. So I left the hive, they took away all my stripes and broke off both my wings. So I'll find another tree make the wind my friend. I'll just sing with the birds. They'll tell me secrets of the world. Honeybee stuck where he doesn't want to be. Oh, my darling honeybee, I'll come save you even if it means I'll have to face the queen. Now, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-da-da-da-ba-ba. So I'll come prepared. My new friends say they would help me get my loved one back. They say it isn't right to be self-control of your mind, but I choose not to believe that. So we'll meet in the darkness of the night, and I promise I will be there on time. We'll be guided by my new friends. The butterflies bring us back to our own little hive. Oh, my other honeybee, no longer stuck where he doesn't want to be. Darling honeybee, I have saved you, and now that you're with me, we can make our own honey. Oh, ba-dum, bum, ba-dum, bum, ba-da-da-da-ba-ba-da-dum.
Hi, you're listening to Live Culture with Martha Willette Lewis. My next guest is going to be Paul Klabbe. Paul Klabbe is curator at the John Slade Eli House, which is slated to close its doors in July. And we wanted to talk to Paul and celebrate the past shows and the history of this place, which has, over the years, there's been an extraordinary range of programming there for artists, community groups, and I think it's worth having a discussion about it and talking about how wonderful the place is. So I was hoping that Paul could start off by telling us a little bit about the history of the John Slade Eli House.
Sure thing. Good morning. John Slade Eli House was created by Grace Taylor Eli, the wife of John Slade Eli, around 1960. She left in her will a trust fund for it to be used for the promotion of fine arts in New Haven, along with a few other uses. Originally, there were different groups like Alcoholics Anonymous and various other things that were there, which were kind of like along the way they found other houses. So originally, the way it was set up was there were several groups that were named to host their exhibits there. And then over time, different curators brought in additional groups, and a curator was employed there to fill out the schedule with, you know, more or less like professionally organized thematic exhibitions.
And when did it start operating as a contemporary art center? Was that 1960, I believe?
I believe it was 1961, I think. And
so there was there's an extraordinary range of exhibits. You had a retrospective for Joan and Frank Gardner. You've had Doll-like, which is a large exhibit
show,
with Debbie Hess. That was a recent one. You've had the annual Elizabeth Greeley High School exhibit.
Yes. One of my favorite shows.
One of your favorite shows. You do the Connecticut Prisons Art Program. So many things. So I wanted you to pick a few things and talk about them here.
Sure. I'd love to. I mean, first of all, I want to mention the high school show because it was created by Elizabeth Greeley, and it was created in a way that I think was pretty smart.
Who was Elizabeth Greeley?
She was a curator at the Greeley House for a period up until 1985. Mm-hmm. She unfortunately died from a heart attack, and it was a great loss. But she had the idea of doing a high school show where everybody that was entered was in the show. There was mm-hmm. no juring work out, mm-hmm. you know, which was a really great idea not to subject students to that
more,
kind of...
more filtering.
You know, so basically... everybody, you know, it was putting some trust in the teachers who had spent the time with the students and knew who was really deserving mm-hmm. of the opportunity. And
it's a show that's meant for not just one high school, but it's all
it's regional.
Regional
it goes
high schools.
It goes as
so
far
it's a fantastic
up as
range.
It goes as far as Madison mm-hmm. over to Woodbridge and down to Milford, and participation would vary from year to year, it would mm-hmm. go up and down, but generally about 15 schools would participate. So basically, the students had this opportunity to see their work presented in a professional setting, mm-hmm. and they were eligible for awards, mm-hmm. Which is something they could use for their applications
right.
for college.
Right.
And there was a second part to the program, the Elizabeth Greeley portfolio competition, mm-hmm. where the students would have a role in selecting which works to put together into mm-hmm. a portfolio
right.
and a statement about what their plans,
purpose
was.
Which is incredibly helpful.
Yes, yes.
And I just want to say something about the professional setting, because one of the things, if you haven't been to the John Slade Ely House, I suggest that you go. It is a very, very beautiful, it's 1906, something like that?
Yeah, it's around, it's the style of the building is called Elizabethan.
Yeah.
And at the time, there was a revival of that mm-hmm, style. There's mm-hmm. several houses in New Haven made in this style, but it's
right.
a mix of like Moorish, Spanish, English mm-hmm. styles.
It's beautiful, though. It has sort of spacious rooms, wood paneling, fireplaces, an elaborately sculpted ceiling. It's a very grand and yet welcoming environment.
Yes, it's a very... I've always thought it's a very comfortable place to view art compared to the white box museums.
It is, because I think you made it that way.
Well, maybe, but I felt like... because there were all these different rooms, like mm-hmm. being a house, that, you know, you could turn the corner and see something different.
Yes.
Or get away from, you know, you don't want to be next to me.
Yeah.
So,
No, one of the things that I found striking over the years is, and this is a disclaimer, I have also showed, Paul has mm-hmm. curated me into an exhibit there, so I know firsthand how wonderful... it is to work with him. He's very kind of relaxed about how things, how the artist approaches the space, and yet the shows are very thoughtfully put in the specific locations and rooms, and they become part of the exhibition. Very much how the works are shown is quite important.
Yeah, well, that's true, and I have to say that the architecture. Creating a show in a house presents a whole different problem mm-hmm, than mm-hmm. you do in a lot of contemporary
right.
galleries, because you have opportunities in that you can put different work of different kind of styles in a show and not have to have them next to each other, which
right.
in certain gallery situations becomes very awkward. And also this kind of idea of, like, traveling through a house mm-hmm. kind of offers this kind of surprise that when you turn
right.
and go through the next door, you know, it's like almost like the opposite of a lot of contemporary curated shows where it's too much the same. They're too
right.
tightly curated.
Mm-hmm.
And so the Ely House really offered an opportunity for actually creating kind of... thematic shows, but actually little small one-person shows all
mm-hmm.
at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so you could get to see 5 to 10 works by an artist.
Yes, and back to the Greeley student shows. This really does give the students a wonderful opportunity to show in a very professional environment. It looks beautiful. They can come and celebrate, but also they get practical information about portfolio development and so forth. So is that going on this year?
That will be our next show, and
okay.
The high school show this year will be April 22nd through May 3rd.
Fantastic.
And we have a reception and awards ceremony on the last day, May 3rd. It's a Sunday.
So save the date and come on by.
And the show that is following that up is also one of my favorite shows. It's created by a very talented very passionate individual by the name of Jeffrey Green, and he's been working for probably 20 years on the Connecticut Prison Arts Program, which involves teachers that go into the prisons and help, you know, work with people to practice, make art.
And what kinds of things are they making?
All kinds of things. Very, very imaginative work. They're working with very, a minimum of materials.
Right. I'm imagining it's quite limited what they're allowed to use.
Yes. But I have to say, one thing, you know, I am impressed with the art, but what I'm much more impressed with the Connecticut Prison Arts Program is the response of the families and people that come to see the show, because for a lot of people who are incarcerated, they haven't had much good happen in their life. They've had lots of bad things happen. And it's a very – people don't realize, like, how difficult it is for families of somebody who's incarcerated. And when they come and see that, they see their work presented in a professional setting.
In a professional and beautiful setting,
and
right.
And Jeffrey goes so far beyond what – almost any normal person would do to present. I mean, he all the work is behind plexiglass mounted.
So tell us again what the dates for that are.
Oh, the dates for that are May 10th through June 7th, and we're going to have a reception on Sunday, May 17th. 2 to 5
May 17th,
p.m.
So mark your calendars. Again, I am Martha Ouellette Lewis. This show is Live Culture. I'm talking to you from WPKN 89.5 on your FM dial. And I am speaking right now with Paul Klabbe, who is curator at the John Slade Eli House, which is slated to close in July, but we are celebrating its glorious past and discussing what is going to be going on in the programming until that point. So what happens after the Connecticut Prison Arts?
Well, presumably we'll have the Connecticut Watercolor Society.
So that's one of the things that the Eli House has a lot of. It has a lot of different societies and clubs that appear to make use of it.
That's right. Yeah, about half of the program. And then the other half of the program, I curate the exhibitions and...
And they use the space not just for exhibiting some of these clubs. They actually have life drawing and model sessions and so forth.
Yes, there's a studio in the facility where people meet 4 days a week and do portrait and figure painting and drawing. And
so is this true for the Watercolor Society as well?
No, the Watercolor Society is a little bit different because their memberships are a little bit more spread out in the state. They tend to be more north and along the shoreline. You know, most of our activity includes New Haven to a strong degree. I mean, even if we have a curated exhibition, it's rarely ever not New Haven artists included. We've occasionally done, international shows, work from an artist from England, but
you also had a show with Pan Latin Yale MFA students.
Yeah, we had
the MFAs. And you had some show that had art from Brazil fairly recently.
We had an artist, Manuel Lopez Garcia, from Cuba.
It's fantastic.
Well, it was fantastic because it was organized by a woman, Lillian Guerra, who is a professor at Yale in the Iberian Latin Studies program. We've we've worked with them on several exhibitions, and she was doing research in Cuba, had made about 25 trips, and brought all this work to New Haven, and we had the exhibition, and it was really interesting because there are communities, believe it or not, still in, you know, 2000 and something that don't feel that they're presented or seen anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And the response to that exhibition that I saw in the audience was a very good thing to see.
No, that's fantastic.
And that's why I've also continued. We've done several shows like the Pan Latino show and also the Brazil show.
So you're looking specifically for audiences that you
I
feel
did.
Are underrepresented
yeah.
to put into the
yeah.
gallery space. So there you've had so many really beautiful exhibits. I think I mentioned the doll show, Doll Like, which you curated, co-curated with Debbie Hess from the Arts
yep.
Council, and something called Community Doll Collection. Were
yeah,
they curating or were they part of it? What is Community Doll Collection?
Well, actually, this was Debbie's idea.
Mm-hmm.
Debbie is a coordinator at the Arts Council.
Mm-hmm.
And
she, a wonderful artist
she,
as well.
Yeah, she's fantastic, and she works with groups. Probably more than I do, but she had this idea of having one room set aside where people could just bring in their doll, and it could be an art piece.
Mm-hmm.
It could be like the first doll they had, and
mm-hmm.
that's exactly what we had. We just had people, but we set up shelves and pedestals, and just people bought dolls.
And they did? Like, did they show up with
oh,
their
yeah,
dolls?
Tons of them. Yeah, it was really interesting. And,
that's amazing.
You know, dolls that people had collected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were at some place in the world and bought dolls, and mm-hmm. they showed up here. So
Was it kind of creepy, too? I personally think of dolls as being slightly creepy, and doll collections in particular as being slightly creepy.
Yeah, I would say... for the most part, the show didn't have a creepy feeling. I think the two artists' work that probably had the creepiest feeling were ones by Joe Sascio,
mm-hmm.
who was a child psychiatrist,
mm-hmm.
and in his practice had used, you know, they used dolls
mm-hmm.
in therapy, and so after he retired, he's, you know, become a full-time sculptor, and
mm-hmm.
he made a whole series of work using dolls, and they were quite strange.
Yes.
And the other piece that I thought was pretty strange was by T. Foley,
mm-hmm.
and she did a video piece with as like a ventriloquist.
Yes.
With the dummy, and the dummy was reading personal ads written by
that
men to women, which was very creepy.
It was creepy and kind of funny.
It was very funny, yes.
Right. And you showed that in one of the upper small rooms in
yeah.
the house.
Yeah.
So it had kind of its own space. I remember watching it with... some other members of the audience. There was a good crowd for that show.
Well, I've always been conscious of these kinds of things, setting up the show. We had a show of an art, Mark Gilbert, who
mm-hmm.
did a residency in a facial reconstruction hospital in London.
Wow.
And his residency was to paint portraits of, well, all of the patients.
Mm-hmm.
And there several of them were children, and there was no way I was going to put them anywhere near where, you know, the first place near the front door. I put them upstairs, and people from the program actually, you know, questioned me, why did I put, you know, they should be down near in the front. And
mm-hmm.
I was like, no, there's no way, because I can't, you can never predict who's going to walk in the door.
Right.
Like, this is not, I mean, the works were actually quite disturbing to many adults.
Mm-hmm.
And
I'm sure.
I wouldn't.
I'm sure.
That show really touched me, too, because,
mm-hmm.
you know, the patients, they kept photographs of the paintings in their wallets and purses
mm-hmm.
because...
It was a real portrait of them.
Well, it was the how they saw themselves.
Ah.
The actual painting, the involvement of the artists with the person getting to know them and everything, spending
mm-hmm.
the time with them, gave them a sense of self
mm-hmm.
that was represented in that picture. And so they kept
That is really moving. So one of the things that listeners will note here is that the John Slade Elay House under Paul's stewardship really does not shy away from difficult subject matter, but also approaches a very, very broad range of kinds of artists and groups. So you have things that are semi-professional clubs and so forth, and then really pretty cutting-edge contemporary art. And one of my all-time favorite shows was a really beautiful show that you did called Life Ascending, Three Views, and it really had to do with the our interconnectedness to animals.
Yes.
And I'm hoping that you can talk a little bit about the show and some of the artists in the show, because it was a really nuanced exhibit and very, very moving.
Yes, I had been reading quite a bit about nature and life, and I was reading at the time a book called Life Ascending by Nick Lane. And one of the things that occurred to me, a simple fact that's overlooked all the time, whenever they talk about life, they talk about variation and mm-hmm. change, and people are confused by this, like, how could it be, you know,
right.
genes change and all that. But the other reality that's almost is astounding to me is that genes are preserved, and that's why life works. Like, you know, genetics now shows like that the same gene that works in a fly to create a wing or an eye is working in us.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have a completely separate set of genes.
It's astonishing.
And really, that kind of knowledge made me think that, you know, it could give me a different feeling about life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had an artist in the show, Frank Nolker, who's
yes.
been on a long-time project to photograph animals.
Animals in zoos, primarily,
in zoos,
correct?
Zoos and preserves.
Mm-hmm.
He had a series of portraits of chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm. Those were astonishing.
They were astonishing. They're also problematic because, like, you know, when we call them portraits, we don't, you know.
What word would you use?
It's a problem because, you know, does the chimpanzee know they're being photographed?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
well, is it
knows,
only a portrait if you know it's being taken?
Well, it's certainly it's a photograph, but I think from Frank's point of view, he spent enough time around chimpanzees mm-hmm. that I think for sure he believes that they're aware.
I think that's probably true. I heard him give a talk, and as I understand it, these are chimpanzees that have been...
They were all rescued.
They're rescued. Many of them have been treated really horribly. A lot of times they were used for scientific testing,
yeah.
and they are psychologically damaged. The effects of their previous life are definitely evident in the pictures of them. So this makes the photographs even more upsetting.
He knew all the chimps by name.
Yes.
And he knew about their personalities. They would even, in some cases, wouldn't like if somebody else, if his attention was turned to somebody else. They would
mm-hmm.
get very angry. And it's an interesting... subject. Yes, I very much like that show.
And tell us a little bit about some of the other artists you had. Jessica Goodyear, Susan Clausen Sullivan, who else?
No, there were three artists,
yeah.
Well, Susan Clausen Sullivan, she's an artist. She teaches at Manchester Community College. She's a sculptor.
Mm-hmm.
She's probably one of Connecticut's best artists, and
She works with porcelain, is that right?
That's right, yeah. She made these probably 5 or 6 foot tall sculptures of frogs that she kept finding frogs when she was running.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd see this frog and that frog. So she started bringing them home and putting them in the freezer.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, I saw the originals. You're talking about like little frogs that are about like an inch and a half, and,
mm-hmm.
and they were just contorted in the mm-hmm. weirdest, like the most human also.
They're in sort of death positions,
yeah.
though, one should say. And in her talk, she likened them to crucifixions.
Yeah, yeah.
But they're...
In fact, like, you know, I don't think she was really happy about being in a show that had to do with animals.
Well, I thought that they have a lot to do with animals.
No,
but
no,
anyway,
but sometimes the artist, what the artist is thinking and what the curator is thinking, just
are different things.
You know,
and Jessica Goodyear.
Jessica,
she did something with Audubon birds and texts.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was really shocked to find out that Jessica had died suddenly.
Oh.
Last year.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And it was very, very sad for me because she was such a wonderful person, and she just one day showed up at the gallery and kept coming back, and we kept talking, and she was a scientist of her own. Like, she created a field that didn't even exist, like the field of like cultural geology about what affects. What effects earthquakes and the changing of rivers had on culture and stuff like this.
Mm-hmm.
And when I proposed the concept for the show, which I had mentioned to you, you know, the life ascending and this idea that life also is like preserving much, is, she was very much opposed to what I was saying because, you know, she... you know, she had probably, when she went to school, she was taught a certain, you know, what was known about evolution. But now there's like a whole, I mean, it's much, people know much more now than they did.
Well, and also not agreeing is, should be an active part of exhibitions, curating.
It was really interesting. Yeah, it was fun. And I have to tell you, in the end, her niece told her about Nick Lane's book and changed your mind completely.
Okay, so you won. So we don't have very much time left. We are going to go to announcements, so I'm going to have to... I have a few minutes left. This is... You're listening to Live Culture. I'm Martha Willette Lewis, and we're talking with Paul Klabbe from the John Slade Eli House. So we just have a few minutes left. Is there anything in particular that we haven't discussed that you feel like we really need to mention in terms of the Eli House? I mean, it's been going for 50 years? 55 years?
Close to 55 years.
And it was meant to be for exhibiting works of art, holding art classes, lectures, and recitals, and a meeting place for organizations interested in any form of art. And I think you've done that.
Yes, thank you. I'm sad about it.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think we all are.
The Ely House is not completely going away. But what is happening is that a granting organization is being created from the assets of the house. So there will be grants available to nonprofits and artists in New Haven.
Okay. So. But before then, you have until July to come and visit and show your love for the John Slade Eli House. And Paul, I want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It's great.
Yes.
It's great to
lovely
talk to
having you. This is Martha Lewis, and you've been listening to Live Culture. We are going to have this program, which will be a discussion about art and culture, the last Saturday of every month from 11 to 12, and I do hope you'll join us. Thank you. We'll be right back.
before she broke her heel.
Did you know that you can take WPKN with you wherever you go? WPKN now has both Apple and Android apps for your mobile devices. Both are free, and the easiest way to get them is to go to our WPKN homepage at WPKN.org and click on the links that will take you to the App Store or Google Play.
Hi, Car Bob here with Diesel Doug and Mark the Mechanic to let you know the 4th annual Car Bob WPKN bus trip to the New York International Auto Show is here again.
And that New York International Auto Show was the world's oldest and biggest. The Car Bob crew has hosted a sold-out bus trip to the show for the last 3 years. Car Bob students, couples, family, and friends have joined us on our deluxe buses, where we pick you up at convenient points in New Haven and Bridgeport and whisk you directly to the auto show. And in the evening, we'll go to Chinatown for dinner and then back to Connecticut.
Tickets are $60 each at brownpapertickets.com or go to WPKN.org for more details.
All proceeds are used to benefit your favorite community, listener-supported radio station. So, don't delay. Reserve your seat today. Doug, Mark, George, and I are looking forward to seeing you on the bus.
See you there.
Hi, I'm Ann. I'm a longtime listener of WPKN. I wanted to let you know that donating a vehicle is a really simple process. All you have to do is go to WPKN.org. You fill in a small bit of information, then submit it. For me, it took about 5 minutes to get a call back, then one follow-up call to set everything up. They were out the next day with a tow truck and took care of it all from there. If you're considering donating a car to help PKN, go for it. By donating, you avoid all the hassles of selling the vehicle yourself. Forget about the low offers, mechanical repairs, and liability issues, and not posting your phone number is also a big plus. My payment comes in the form of a tax deduction, but more than that, I get the great feeling of helping out my favorite radio station. WPKN needs our support, so it can remain the independent, freeform radio station that is such a rare find today.
On Saturday, March 28th, New Pond Farm, an environmental, education center, and working farm in Reading, is launching its 30th anniversary with a gala at Reading Country Club. Fred Taylor, known as the Mouth Sounds Guy, for his sound effects work with Garrison Keillor on A Prairie Home Companion, is the featured guest. Info is available at newpondfarm.org.
On Saturday, March 28th, Nicholas Merriweather, the founding Grateful Dead archivist at the University of California, Santa Cruz, will present Archiving the Counterculture and Raising the Dead, the Grateful Dead Archive and the Legacy of the 60s at the Kelly Center on the Fairfield University campus. This keynote address of the 3rd Annual American Studies Conference, Race, Protest, and American Culture, is free and open to the public. In 2008, the Grateful Dead gave their sprawling, voluminous archive to UC Santa Cruz, and this talk discusses the achievements of the Grateful Dead and the work of their archive. Merriweather's presentation begins at 4 p.m. at Fairfield University, and reception and music featuring Phantom Road follows.
On Saturday, April 25th, you can ride your bike in Rock to Rock's 7th Annual Earth Day Ride, featuring Athena Health and Alexion as Planet Earth sponsors. You can ride one of 5 route options from West Rock to East Rock, a family-friendly 8 miles, a new adults-only 12-mile ride, a 20-mile loop out to Sleeping Giant State Park, a 40-mile loop, or a metric century through 62 miles of beautiful shoreline, woods, and hills in New Haven County. The ride helps to fund 24 local organizations doing environmental work, and riders can help even more by collecting pledges. More info, including registration, is at rocktorock.org.
This is WPKN, 89.5 FM in Bridgeport, and streaming online at WPKN.org.
Hello? On the air? We're on the air. Just a minute. Give us a second. The mics, everything are off. Where's my song? See?
You have to entertain us after all. I drop the situation.